You're an entrepreneur. You're a leader. You're a high-performance individual. But many of you are so busy, you're thinking about today only. But what about tomorrow? This is the Alchemist Lounge. We focus in like a laser beam on exploring the art of transformational leadership, company culture, and the alchemical elements of creating and managing healthy and thriving organizations. This is a forum for leaders to hear cutting-edge perspectives, learn how to evolve yourself, and build thriving and sustainable leadership habits and businesses that stand the test of time. Get ready to learn from one of the best, The Alchemist Lounge, with your host, Alex Atwood.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Alchemist Lounge. As always, I'm your host, Alex Atwood, and we have another thrilling episode for you today. We are going to dive deep into the minds of world-class performers, and we're going to specifically talk to Robert Jordan. Robert is the author of a game-changing book titled Right Leader, Right Time. And this book is known far and wide for reshaping business landscapes. And as the CEO of Interim Execs, he's a maestro at placing the right leaders in the right places. His co-authored work, How They Did It, is a beacon of insight, and he was instrumental in launching the negotiation bestseller, Start With No, which seems like a contradiction, but we can dig into that with Robert today. So I want to welcome you, Robert, to the Alchemist Lounge. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. So let's dive in.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you. You said we're going to have a thrilling conversation. Now the pressure is on, buddy.
Hey, man, the pressure is on. Let's think about the business landscape these days. It is evolving at an incredible pace. I mean, we have things like AI dominating the conversation. We have different styles of leadership starting to dominate the conversation. It's now about lots of conversations around servant leadership, transformational leadership. Things are evolving. How do you suggest leaders adapt their leadership style to adapt to all of this ever-changing landscape we have here?
Well, it's a great question, Alex. First is know thyself. The more self-discovery I think any of us can go through, the better, because we're in an age of people seeking genuine connection and trying to get at the authentic of what is, and especially on your teams. So if you're in any organization, you're in a leadership role or not, you know, the degree to which you're going to stick and stay within that and be engaged and really be on that winning team is going to depend a lot on how you feel about everybody around you, and is everyone as engaged in you? Is it truly an authentic experience that you're having? So, you know, we're fans of know exactly what you are bringing to the table. And in particular, our take on that is, you know, we've been researching what we call leadership style.
I like that. Well, what I'm hearing is really it's so important to cultivate relationships within organizations. And what I'm finding is that leaders are starting to hone in on how to optimize their intuition and how to optimize intuition when it comes to being able to understand what the key elements in an organization are, what the key elements in the people in the organization are, what drives them, like truly drives them, not bottom line, but who are these people? What are they about, right? So I guess I'd like to dig into, you have that happening on one end, then you have data-driven insights, right? You have data, right? And sometimes we want to somehow extrapolate data, but synthesize it with your intuition on what you know organically to grow a company. So from your experience, you know, how do we do this?
It's so great you're diving into this. We interviewed a lot of leaders for the book, Right Leader, Right Time. We also interviewed a number of organizational psychologists, because we just wanted to ask, are we crazy? We have a framework. We have a thesis here, which is leadership style, referring to someone's process and approach and system, and saying that exceptional leaders exhibit one of four different kinds of style in dominant mode. We call them fixer, artist, builder, strategist. Okay. Mm-hmm. And one of these brilliant organizational psychologists, he agreed with us, which was a relief. And he said, you know, there's research, good research out there that about 90% of leaders are in the wrong role. That's sobering. But one of the other comments we heard from him was that he said, you know, none of us are actually in business because of business. That's not the way humans are wired. We do what we do because we are goal seeking. You know, we are creatures that need tasks. We need work. We need productivity. You know, I can't remember if it was Freud or Jung, but he basically said, there are only two things going on here, love and work. That's it. But anyway, the psychologist, he said, there are these deeper things that are going on here and that we express ourselves through work. And I just thought that was key. And so, you know, we can all talk about the bottom line and we could talk about accountability and responsibility because it is necessary and it is vital for trust on teams. But there is a basic thing going on about us belonging within an organization, you know, in the primitive sense, it's tribe. You know, there's a reason why when, you know, Facebook got big and someone had thousands of connections that you could sense that was not genuine. You know, humans are, it's very hard to be in some form of relationship with more than 150 people. So we're getting at leadership style. And in all of those styles, trust is key. It is interesting for us, the styles we identify in what we call fixer, artist, builder, strategist. Fixer, artist, and builder tend to be within organizations or team size of 5, 10, 50, maybe 100. Those styles are heavily dependent on personal relationship and trust to get work done. The four-style strategist is very applicable in complex and large organization where there are some trusted personal relationships, but where the challenge is different because the organization is vast, complex, and other forms of leadership are needed that are beyond, you know, what Stephen Covey called personal span of control.
I'm really wanting to synthesize all of this because what I'm hearing on one end, which is extremely powerful, is that people are at work and they do work for a bigger cause. And that's why they come together. There's something inside them that drives them to build, to expand. People naturally, what I heard was, want to expand. They want to build. And they're forming together in these tribes. When you go through your leadership styles, what you're looking at is, when you think of fixer, you're looking at somebody that is a tactician, is what I'm hearing. Somebody that in meetings may lean towards, or in collaborative situations may lean towards fixing, right? So all of these different leadership styles, are you looking to have them work in synergy together? In other words, are we looking to put them into certain organizational structures? How do we get them to enhance their leadership styles for the benefit of the organization, ultimately wanting to nourish and enhance what is clear, that people are there for something bigger than themselves?
Well, all successful organizations are a mix of people with those styles. And to be very clear, I mean, like we developed a leadership assessment. It's called FABS for Fixer, Artist, Builder, Strategist, FABS. FABS Leadership Assessment. We are not trying to pigeonhole any leader and to say, you're only this one thing. Our view is more that, you know, there are these four distinct styles. We believe exceptional leaders tend to exhibit a dominant or a dominant and a secondary. But it's also a little bit like DNA, right? There are only four kinds of protein, four nucleotides that make up DNA. And whether it's your Aunt Mary, your puppy, the oak tree outside, it's just infinite variation of four proteins that make up DNA. And that's what you and I are in our leadership roles. It is infinite variety, but to be successful, we believe there is a dominant or dominant and a secondary that comes out over the course of your career. To give you an example for, you know, as you and I are recording this, FTX, one of the largest crypto exchanges, it went into bankruptcy about 4 months ago. And the court appointed a new CEO named John Ray. And where was John before FTX? He was at Enron. He didn't cause the problems, but Enron has been a multi-decade toxic corporate dump that needed years to clean up. And so that kind of energy, fixer is the label to an energy where you as a leader see the world, you have to go into burning buildings. It's what drives you. If you're in a steady state business and you're in a fixer, you're going to go crazy or start breaking things.
Mm. That leads me to a question. So something that leaders run into all the time, no matter where you are, is a difficult conversations. All leaders need to face them, right? And it occurs to me that someone who's a fixer may not have that leadership, at least dominant leadership style of maybe empathy, right? So can you give some practical strategies to a leader who needs to potentially shift from a non-dominant to more of that dominant style, or how to handle that situation?
Well, it's a great point. Each one of these styles, when you start diving into these styles, fixer, artist, builder, strategist, I don't know that you can typecast any one of them and say, oh, this is a personality which necessarily goes with it. But one of the consistent things which is interesting about fixer energy, and this is someone who loves turnaround, they have to have broken organizations to go fix. One of the comforts in a way for a leader wired that way is, I mean, one of the quotes we heard repeatedly was, well, when it's broken, you actually can do a whole lot more. Because in organizations that are supposedly doing okay or humming along or whatever, to actually have impact as one person, the organization has sufficient mass, it's hard. When you go into something that's broken, the fixer in a way is comforted because everyone knows it's all on the line. And so you can get a straight line to much further impact than you could under, say, steady state. You know, it's interesting that we have just gone through COVID, and we've just crossed the 1 year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The average length of time, LNG, liquefied natural gas, the average length of time to build a plant, these are multi-billion dollar complex engineering projects, averages 15, 20 years. Germany had no plants. The Russians invade. The supply of oil gets cut off between Russia and Western Europe, including Germany. They are in bad shape. They build an LNG terminal in 200 days. No 15 years. The leaders in Germany simply asked, what is the physics of this? Not the politics. No more anything with politics. Not the money. Nothing. What is the physics of how fast can you build a high-quality terminal and production facility? 200 days. That is fixer energy.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. And something you said that really hit hard was that companies that are broken that need fixing often hold the most opportunity, because companies that are humming along potentially don't need that fixer energy at that moment, or somehow need some sort of boost of energy, which comes into some of what you do. A lot of your work is essentially about change, right? So you have the company humming along. What do you do there in that type of situation where you don't have anything to fix, but humming along could be a death knell for an organization?
Yeah, the humming, and especially, you know, nobody gets a free pass anymore, right? Every market tends to be competitive, subject to disruption. AI is going to hit whatever. And so into that steady state, generally it means you don't have enough artist energy. Mm-hmm. And you need this more renegade disruptive energy. You need your own little Elon Musk on the team, mm-hmm. who's going to be disagreeable, is not going to have a lot of friends on the team. And you know, one of the guys we interviewed, he was at Intel for many years, and Andy Grove, you know, the standout CEO for Intel many years, he said, Andy Grove said of this one guy on his management team, he said, you got to have a wild duck. And he, in a way, didn't mean it as a compliment. He had all this brilliant engineering talent around him, which is, how do we cram more transistors in a chip? How do we, you know, Moore's Law, and we keep driving all this engineering mindset, and how do you build a billion-dollar fabrication plant? And then they had the one outlier who was just far more artistic thinking. And he was the guy that started Intel Ventures, because he could just, his mind was completely uncorked compared to the rest of them. But he wasn't the most popular guy, because he was occasionally saying things that they didn't like it. He was not in lockstep.
You know, there's something I heard recently. I think it was Shirzad Shamin with Positive Intelligence, where 10% of any idea is valid. Just assume 10%, no matter what, how crazy the idea is, assume 10% is valid. Take that 10% and just build on that. And so there was an exercise that I heard. It was an innovation exercise where you literally take as many ideas as you possibly can. And I think some of the rules were, there's every idea is not evaluated, right? So it automatically gets the team.
Improv technique, build on it. Yeah.
Right. Build on it. Exactly. And that's what you're describing. You know, when you have so many, in that case, engineers focusing on one thing, you need that outlier is what I'm hearing, right? Otherwise you hum along. I want to go through some of the other leadership styles and how could they apply to some of these situations?
Sure. So FABS, fixer, artist, builder. Now, everybody in business, we're all builders. Got it. We mean something more specific, which is the energy that takes the small, the nascent, the tiny little team, project, business, and has to drive it to scale. The mantra for builder is market domination. They have market on the brain. And the way they get to that domination, it's always people, process, product. Always. Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of wiring than the others. But what you tend to see with a lot of builder energy is when they hit domination, for example, if somebody hits an IPO, you'll see them rotate off. All of a sudden, they're onto a different company or different team, different project, different country, different division. That is the builder kind of energy that's there. Okay. Standout example. One of the greatest builders of the modern era, Sheryl Sandberg. When she joined Facebook, it was a couple hundred employees, 100 million revenue, sounds like a lot. She said she was signing up for a tour of duty for 5 years. 7 years after she started, 70,000 employees, $100 billion in revenue, 3 billion people using it. I don't know of any greater example of an operating executive creating that level of market domination, right? She's also a cautionary example, because I think of her as being phenomenal. She stayed another 7 years. What happened in the second half? Cambridge Analytica scandal, election problems, pivot to Meta that I'm not sure she was really behind. She wrote a brilliant book called Lean In that she has so many arrows in her back from it. And so, you know, part of our thesis is the way the modern world is organized is that none of us are fixed into one organization our whole life. It's just lifetime employment is gone. I mean, maybe, you know, the U.S. Post Office. Yeah, you can be a postal carrier your life, but there's really no more General Motors anymore that say, get out of school at 22, come here, you're going to spend your entire career here. Hmm. That's not the way the world of work is organized anymore, right? You know this from your own experience launching and growing beautiful companies, you know?
Yeah. I happen to be at the helm of a company now that is a gig marketplace that is effectively moving what you just described into the future, where we see is it's an elastic worker centric marketplace, but really, you know, very powerful, very, very, very powerful. And when you look at the trajectory of Sandberg's career, you see exactly that. You see where lots of organizations, I'm sure, have builders who stayed a little too long and perhaps the artistry was missed. And suddenly you need the fixer to come in and take it. Fascinating. So I know when I first introduced you, I'm really curious in terms of where you came up with that particular theme idea. Tell me a little bit about Starts With No.
So Start With No is a best-selling book on negotiation by Jim Camp. It's still a bestseller. It's now been out over 20 years. Jim was my business partner. He was originally my coach and mentor. He passed away about 5 years ago. But he was acknowledged as one of the foremost negotiation coaches in the world. And he was kind of a secret weapon most of his life. When I met him, I was in a bad space. I was getting the stuffing pounded out of me by a venture fund on a business. And by chance, I don't really believe in chance, Alex, but I just say that. By chance, I was at an Inc. 500 conference, and Jim was there giving he was one of the featured speakers talking about negotiation. He had a workbook. It was incredible. It was completely contrarian to the only book that was really on the market that everyone knew called Getting to Yes. Getting to Yes was authored by some Harvard PhDs. And so I got to know Jeff. He was Jim, and he was coaching me. And I said, we got to publish your workbook. And he said, no. He said no for 2 years. And then he said, all right, fine. We're partners. 5 years later, big publisher, Penguin Random House, published the book. And translated into 20 languages. It a remarkable accomplishment. The reason it was called Start With No is that Penguin Random House is a commercial business. And there was only one book on negotiation out called Getting to Yes. And they said, if you want us to publish this, it's called Start With No. And we said, that's a great idea. It's called Start With No. And the idea was not meant to be nasty or negative. What had followed was this idea that what is negotiation? If you look it up in a dictionary, it is the coming to agreement of two parties with either having the right to veto. Yeah. And so all that Jim was doing was saying, this is the way the world really negotiates. Getting to yes was this piece of fiction that was only invented in America because of legislation that forced unions and railroads to come together, that they had to negotiate. The rest of the world doesn't operate that way. And so in America, you had a concept coming out called win-win. What Jim said is, I can't read the other guy's mind. And so one of the principles was, yes, let's see if we can figure this out in a negotiation, but each of us has the right to say no. The secret was, when you say no, now you actually get to the truth. Doesn't mean you're not going to get a deal done, but you will get to the truth when everyone is free to actually say, nope, this doesn't work for me. And Alex, I got to tell you, one of the things we didn't do when it was published 20 years ago, it wasn't an automatic that you did an audible version of a book. And so at the end of COVID, I got to go into a recording studio for 3 days, record the unabridged version of Start With No, and I got to riff. And I was very grateful to Penguin Random House. I said, this was my dear friend. I love this guy. He passed, and I have to do a riff or two in there. And they said, knock your socks off. So, I hear from people all the time how Start With No kind of changed their life or changed their trajectory in business.
Mm. Well, it's one of those classics. And hearing the story behind it is absolutely, as we said, it's fascinating. What was the word we used in the introduction? Thrilling. There we go. Thrilling. So that's our bar that we set in the introduction. And I think we're getting
a high bar. Yes.
It's a high bar, but that was a pretty good story. Which, look, I'm really curious. You've had so much success in business as an author. What I'm really curious about is, how do you maintain your own learning curve? There's just so much to learn. How, you know, you're guiding others, you've learned so much. How do you stay curious? How do you maintain that?
Man, that's a great question. I don't know if you necessarily have to be wired for it, but I absolutely, it's simply part of how I am wired that I am going to stay that way. I'm a reading machine, for one thing. I read a lot. And I also think, at least personally, you know, you can go crazy in, you know, the way the world is wired. You know, one of the epidemics we have is distraction.
Yeah.
And so I've been meditating. I'm a big fan of TM, Transcendental Meditation. I've been meditating for 30 plus years. And there has to be a core of you. There's got to be a center of you. You know, every time I think that there's something challenging me and it's the problem out there, it's with this person and this business and why didn't we win this gig and blah, 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 and all of that. And it's at some point to remember, we have met the enemy and he is us. And so that's it. And it is only in being able to have this pause to just breathe that you get a chance at hearing the still small voice. It's our only shot at it. And I'm not telling you that it is easy. Our business, for example, we've had this great run. Now it's become more widespread and we have to pivot. Easy to say, it's painful, but we're doing it. But it's painful.
Yes. And I share the enthusiasm and the practice and the commitment to TM. So I learned TM in 2009.
I knew you were a fellow floater. I knew it.
Yeah, I've actually gone through all four of the advanced techniques. I was trained by Mario Arsati, who's, I don't know if you've met Mario, if you've been in the program for very long, but where I was able to build that commitment was through Bob Roth, who's the president of the David Lynch Foundation, started a week or daily, twice a day meditation, which included a check-in. And for those of you that are familiar with or not familiar with Transcendental Meditation, there's a process that you go through in order to learn the technique. And then once you learn the technique, you are then a member for life. And you can always go to a local TM center and get your technique checked in on and refresh your technique. And sometimes that's necessary. So right before the pandemic, I happened to do a TM check-in at my local DC TM center. And Bob Roth actually started doing daily live every day, not just the weekdays, every day at 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. You'd go on with Bob. He would effectively talk. Sometimes he would talk about brain science, neural network. Sometimes he would talk about outer space. Sometimes he would just talk about chipmunks and leaves. Whatever it was, there was a 5-minute conversation. We'd all drop in together and we do that. And I'll tell you, that consistency around meditation has allowed me to expand beyond where I believe would be possible without that. And it is also, so it's simple and it's not necessarily easy to maintain that sort of commitment. So I say all that because I appreciate TM and I appreciate what you said about really starting to get in touch with yourself as a leader. And once you really start to get in touch with yourself and stop judging yourself so much and beating yourself up, I think you're able to find vulnerability and compassion for those around you. And also your productivity is completely exponential.
I appreciate that, Alex. And I'd pick up on the word compassion because it is also compassion for yourself. It's just, you know, we're in an age of FOMO and, you cannot have it all, nor should you. And so the compassion first has to start with yourself, which is, you know, if you are going to strive and you're going to have ambition and that's great, then you are going to fall short. And no matter how high you go, you are, and you're going to screw up every day. And, you know, one of my favorite questions, we interviewed a lot of leaders for the book, Right Leader, Right Time. And one of my favorite questions was, what happened on your worst day? And we didn't mean an amalgamation. We didn't mean hazy, like, well, the team is distracted or our sales. I didn't mean that. I meant literally, what was that day where you hit bottom? And everybody has that. If they're going to be honest, if they're going to be vulnerable, they have that. Then you're starting to get it. What's your secret sauce? And how is it that you can still achieve despite that? Or because of that?
Yeah, that's right. And being that what drives organizations is something much more than the compensation or really necessarily the mission of the organization. It really is much deeper than that.
We asked that question of all these wonderful leaders, and you know, there were, to my mind, in a way, shocking answers. For example, one of the artist leaders we interviewed, I said, "What happened on your worst day?" He said, "I was ignored." This blew me away, because I thought that's kind of the essence of artist innovation, is that you have to enlist and enroll. You're working against or with the world. It was kind of incredible. Carol Burnick is a strategist. She had run Alberto Culver, big multi-billion dollar business. Her parents had set it up. She was the featured strategist leader. We said, "What happened on your worst day?" She said, "The plant blew up and 4 workers died." Now there's an order of magnitude, which is, as a leader, what do you do when people die on your watch? Now the plant that blew up wasn't in the US, it was in Mexico. It wasn't owned by Alberto Culver. Didn't matter. They were one of the manufacturers who was in there. There were other companies manufacturing. Didn't matter. They ended up, you know, doing as much as they could for healing in the community, including things like paying for all of the children of those folks for their education, all of it. You know, trying to be good humans in face of tragedy. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's what capitalism needs. I mean, capitalism has really gone a bit awry.
Well, it has. You know, it's unfortunate it was named by its worst enemy. You know, Karl Marx called it capitalism, and it stuck. And it's so inaccurate, because yes, there is money in the system, but that's not the core of what it is. That's just a form of glue. Capable, you know, what you and I do in our worlds is to work for the betterment of the world. It's about bringing all of your humanness and your energy to what you are doing. But, you know, he got to name it. And it is, to your point, there absolutely are excesses. And it is not, what was it, Winston Churchill said, it's a terrible system. We just don't have anything better.
Well, names mean a lot. What I've learned is language is where life is created. So calling it capitalism, it's going to be capitalism. At the end of the day, that's going to be the god of what this is. Whether or not that's our intention, the view is that. And what I would invite leaders to ascribe to is that any organization is made up of human beings coming together to expand, to create, not just the organization, but themselves. And how can leaders be there to help the people in the organization empower themselves, expand to their potential? And the only way to really know how to do that is to connect with the people in your organizations, you know, whether it's leadership, and you can discover. And what's so beautiful about the leadership styles that you outline there is it gives you some context. It gives you an ability to really lean into what people in your organizations can be as productive, and really not just productive, as supported, because, you know, what they are most comfortable and what they feel that they can bring to an organization is impacting the organization, and it's identified. And hopefully it doesn't self-limit. In other words, if I am a builder, I want to also maybe try out my artistry skills, right? So perhaps identifying myself as a builder also allows me to open up possibility hey, I didn't even realize I was a builder. Now I'm aware of the fact that I'm a builder. Perhaps there's something I can learn on the other side of this. So what you did with starts with no there was groundbreaking, but ground is so fertile, as you know, for more groundbreaking thought leadership work. And leaders are such in need of this now because we're going through a seismic shift in business, in culture, in communication. So thank you so much for being a guiding light here. What would you want to leave our audience with? And feel free to work some alchemy into it.
Which, by the way, I love the title because this is your intent in terms of alchemy. I love that. We're very big on this idea of that leaders have a highest and best use. And more than that, what we've observed of exceptional leaders is they tend to reject more of what is not for their highest and best use. And it's very easy to say, incredibly hard to do, especially early in your career. And so it is the thing, though, for people on the journey, and especially earlier in the journey, to simply be noticing and aware of the decisions you're making and how your career is going and how it is progressing, because it's easier to see with hindsight. And so with great leaders, you can see as you're looking at that journey for themselves or other people observing that there is in fact a highest and best use, which is being expressed by people who are really excelling. I think it is open to everybody. It is something that hopefully you become more and more intentional over time. Mm. Your intent is key. Mm.
Yes. And that for many years has been lost. Leaders have been distracted. So beautiful. Thank you so much. What an incredible, incredible conversation. Thank you for sharing so much wisdom. You've really disrupted my thinking around so many things. The terminology around capitalism, how the title starts with no actually happened. And thank you for continuing to disrupt as you go out there and just being an everlong learner.
Well, Alex, you're very kind. It's been a pleasure. And I have to say, you know, I'm student here. All of this stuff is learning from people far more capable than I am. I want to stay in that learning mode.
That's beautiful. What a beautiful way to end. Never stop learning. Thank you so much for being on the show. Oh, and wait, before we let you go, if anyone wants to learn more about you or wants to learn more about the work you're up to, how can they find your work?
I can be reached at interimexecs.com. And if anybody would like to take the FABS leadership assessment, it's at rightleader.com.
You guys hear that? Rightleader.com. I'm going to take that. I'm going to apply what I've learned here to my own organization. And I suggest that you do too. Rightleaders.com. Thank you so much, Robert. And we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks, Alex.
You've been listening to The Alchemist Lounge. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you did, make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, find Alex on LinkedIn and Twitter at Alex Atwood and on Instagram at Alex_Atwood_coaching. See you next time on The Alchemist Lounge.